It is kind of a blustery day. I thought it'd be a good time, good evening, just to sit and read some poems that I like. I've been doing this all week, but I usually do all Emily Dickinson or Whitman or Frost or somebody, but I thought it might be nice. I've never done this before at Holding. Usually I'm reading my own stuff, but it'd be nice just to read guys I like, and if you want to talk about them, we can talk about them. Otherwise, just settle back, and I'm going to read to you. All right. I want to start off with a poem by a man that I hope some of you know, Mark Van Doren. Now, I hear some nods and some grunts over there. Great. Van Doren died in 1972, and he lived for 50 years in Cornwall, Holland, Connecticut. Maybe you know where the Cornwalls are in Connecticut. It's about, 50 miles west of Hartford, something like that. And a little farm, 140 acres of rolling mountainside, full of mountain laurel and pine and fern. Just the kind of place we all need to have. I visited the Van Doren farm about 3 weeks ago. I spent a week back there reading his papers walking around the farm, with beautiful rolling hills and walks, and these old brick walls, you know, all through Connecticut. Stone walls, yeah, not brick. I got brick on the mind because of John's walk. Everything's brick. It'd be brick walks to heaven. And he's got a big barn and several little barns and crabapple trees and flowers of all kinds. And then 50 yards from his house is an old mill with a stream, a trout pond, and a stream running under the mill, turning a mill wheel. He's one of those kinds of pictures that you think only exists in postcards. He bought this in 1922 for $5,000. 150 acres or whatever. And way down in the corner of the property is a cemetery, just about 15 stones. The earliest one person died in 1757. That's really history, isn't it? That has nothing to do with the poem I've read. I just thought I'd say that. It might help to put poems in context. But this poem by Van Doren is called I Mean Weather. That's why I chose it, because of this weather. When I say weather, I mean weather. Not this eternal waiting for something to happen. I mean the happening. Wind of a sudden, thunder and screams of lightning, and then, of course, rain. Blasts of it blearing these windows. And what do I care if it breaks a few? In a minute, the wind will stop, and the water and straight down streams will drum on the dry ground all day. All night, till the sound of it changes to gurgling, and little rivers run together in puddles and pools, oh, everywhere, as if the earth had smiling eyes all over its body, as maybe I do. I do. Van Doren's a very fine writer, and if you haven't read him before, you might like to pick up this little book. We got it in the bookstore. It's called 100 Poems, with a picture of Mark on the very handsome man he was. And it's in the bookstore, and it's a good selection of his poems. He wrote short stories, 3 volumes of short stories, 3 novels, 4 plays, 17 books of criticism, and over 50 books in all. Won the Pulitzer Prize in 1940. Some of you may be more familiar with his brother, Carl Van Doren, who's a historian. Won the Pulitzer Prize for history in 1939 with a biography of somebody.
Ben Franklin.
Ben Franklin, thank you. Bless your heart. I was going to say Lincoln, but that's Sandburg. Yeah. Here's another poem by Van Doren, which I like very much. It's called Sleep, Grandmother. Sleep, grandmother, sleep. The rocking chair is ready to go, and harness bells are hung in a row as once you heard them in soft snow. Sleep, grandmother, sleep. Your sons are little and silly again. Your daughters are 5 and 7 and 10, and he that is gone was not gone then. Sleep, grandmother, sleep. The sleigh comes out of the winter woods and carries you all in boots and hoods to town for candy and white-dressed goods. Sleep, grandmother, sleep. The rocking chair as old as the floor. But there he nods at the noisy door for you to be dancing one dance more. That's nice, isn't it? This is good weather for all kinds of poems. I've got a list of, I think, 99 poems here, which I can't possibly read. And give me a couple. Have you found those two poems? Ruth just came in here and sat down, and I asked her, prevailed on her to run out in the elements to get a couple of her poems. This is Ruth Cady, who is recently up here on staff and will recently return to the lowlands. Ruth had planned to be up here for, what, 3 months? Mm-hmm. And just got a letter today from the dean of California Lutheran College informing her that she'd been won an assistantship in creative writing to San Diego State University, which she hadn't dreamed about, really, and so she's off. But I want to read a couple of her poems since she's here. Here's a little poem called Nothing. She says, no titles. Like Emily Dickinson, no titles. Won't grow in Southern California, so everybody says, pointing to the facts of an endless sun and Mediterranean climate. Dormancy, a cold sleep, that's what's missing. Well, every April, with a sprig of my mother's lilac, I can prove them wrong. Here's another one with no titles. I'll quit saying that, because none of them have titles, I guess. More than once, eating my lunch by the plate glass window, overlooking the lawn, I've heard a crash and have gone outside to watch the last convulsions, chase cats away, and hold the warm body to my lips. Walking from the spot, I've muttered to myself, time, 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 I'll have my ham sandwich with such flying reminders more than once. A short poem called After Her Shower. A woman should naked stand in the shuttered light of afternoon, water hanging in the small of her back, then rushing down to the ankles, leaving a damp spot on the rug. All your words won't uncurl me now. I've heard too many say this is good and that, and now like a pill bug, I'm all curled up. I touched a pill bug last week with a stick, then waited for it to straighten. If you push too hard, they never do. So talk on. You're this is good and you're that. The last smile was enough. I'll not uncurl for you. Thank you, Ruth. Pleasure to read your poems. How about Robert Frost? I don't have to tell any stories about Robert Frost, do I? Because you all know who and where he was. Oh, he was close to Van Dorn. He was up in Vermont. His farms. Was it Ripton? Anybody from Ripton, Vermont? Anybody from Vermont? Anybody from Minnesota? What a question. Yeah, I don't even ask that. Last August, everybody was from Albert Lea. Everybody. I thought I was from Minnesota after a while. I wasn't. Robert Frost's poems are really nice poems, too, especially on days like this. It's kind of a coming out of the wet kind of a guy. He starts out with just little bitty poems that you don't have, some of them you don't have to think about, and just kind of enjoy, you know. Like when he says in a poem called The Pasture, I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. I'll only stop to rake the leaves away and wait to watch the water clear, I may. I shan't be gone long. You come too. I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by the mother. It's so young, it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long. You come too. How's that for an invitation? And we can leave the critics muttering to themselves, what does it mean? What does it really mean? Well, you know, the critics ask Frost, of course. He says, it really means that. He says, no. He says, have you seen my spring? It's got leaves in it. They're not interested in that. How about this one? I know you remember this one, The Road Not Taken. Just pretend it's up here in Holden with all these trails. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other, as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had warned them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet knowing how way leads on the way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Of course, we don't know what difference that might have made. Everybody always thinks it means a good difference. Oh, maybe it does. What do you like by frost? Well, I've got frost open. How about stopping by the woods on a snowy evening? You like that? It's not snowing. Can you pretend it's snowing?
No.
Oh. Well, I can't read that one. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. Don't we all? Now I want to read you something else by Frost called Departmental, which is a little bit different. Frost always has these kind of solemn head-wagging poems that you hear and you say, that's right, and stroke your beard even if you don't have one. But he could play around, too. This is a poem, very solemn, but it's not really solemn. It's called Departmental. It's about an ant. Well, ants ought to be written about as well as noble things, right? An ant on the tablecloth ran into a dormant moth of many times his size. He showed not the least surprise. His business wasn't with such. He gave it scarcely a touch and was off on his duty run. Yet if he encountered one of the hive's inquiry squad, whose work it is to find out God and the nature of time and space, he would put him onto the case. Answer, curious race. One crossing with hurried tread the body of one of their dead isn't given a moment's arrest, seems not even impressed. But he no doubt reports to any with whom he crosses antennae, and they no doubt report to the higher up at court. Then word goes forth in formic, death's come to Jerry McCormick. Our selfless forager Jerry, will the special Janissary, whose office it is to bury the dead of the commissary, go bring him home to his people, lay him in state on a sepulchre, wrap him for shroud in a petal, embalm him with ichor of nettle. This is the word of your queen. And presently on the scene appears a solemn mortician, and taking formal position, with feelers calmly a twiddle, seizes the dead by the middle, and heaving him high in air, carries him out of there. No one stands round to stare. It is nobody else's affair. It couldn't be called ungentle, but how thoroughly departmental. Now, Frost is a good man. E.E. Cummings is another favorite poet of mine, and I hope of yours. And he has a poem, I've got so many books here now that I'm getting lost, called Nobody Loses All the Time. And if any of you have ever felt like, surely you do lose all the time, take heart from this guy, will you? Nobody loses all the time. I had an uncle named Saul who was a born failure, and nearly everybody said he should have gone into vaudeville, perhaps, because my uncle Saul could sing McCann, He Was a Diver on Christmas Eve like hell itself, which may or may not account for the fact that my uncle Saul indulged in that possibly most inexcusable of all, to use a highfalutin phrase, luxuries, that is, to wit, farming. And be it needlessly added that my uncle Saul's farm failed because the chickens ate the vegetables. So my uncle Saul had a chicken farm. Till the skunks ate the chickens. And my uncle Saul had a skunk farm. The skunks caught cold and died, and so my Uncle Saul imitated the skunks in a subtle manner, or by drowning himself in a water tank. For somebody who'd given my Uncle Saul a Victor Victrola and records while he lived, presented to him upon the auspicious occasion of his decease a scrumptious, not to mention splendiferous funeral with tall boys in black gloves and flowers and everything. And I remember we all cried like the Missouri when my Uncle Saul's coffin lurched because somebody pressed a button and down went my Uncle Saul and started a worm farm. He's finally a winner. What a way to find out. Cummings was an interesting guy. Those of you who read his poems, you know he didn't like capital letters very much, and he inserted asterisks and quotation marks and all kinds of stuff. He was really trying to rebel against formalism and things like that. He wanted to be free and breathe a little bit. He's one of the people who thought poetry belonged out on the streets and not necessarily in the ivory towers of academicians. And I think he's probably right. Listen to this little poem. It's called "May I Feel," said he. Are you ready for this? "May I feel," said he. "I'll squeal," said she. "Just once," said he. "It's fun," said she. "May I touch," said he. "How much," said she. "A lot," said he. "Why not," said she. "Let's go," said he. "Not too far," said she. "What's too far," said he. "Where you are," said she. "May I stay," said he. "Which way," said she. "Like this," said he. "If you kiss," said she. "May I move," said he. "Is it love," said she. "If you're willing," said he. "But you're killing," said she. "But it's life," said he. "But your wife," said she. "Now," said he. "Ow," said she. "Tip top," said he. "Don't stop," said she. "Oh no," said he. "Go slow," said she. "Come," said he. "Mmm," said she. "You're divine," said he. "You are mine," said she. Here's another guy that I'm fond of, E.A. Masters, or E.L. Masters, Edgar Lee Masters, who wrote a book that I'm sure you're familiar with called Spoon River Anthology. And some of his poems are in this particular collection. Spoon River Anthology is a great thing. In fact, we did it. Remember, Rudy, here last August, for any of you who were here, they did it on stage and a number of people took part. It was really good. There are little excerpts out of people's lives. It's about people. Almost all of the poems have titles of people and their struggles, and the poems are kind of all interrelated. And the people talk to each other. They're all dead and gone, and they're buried on the hill now, and they say their say about life from the perspective of looking backwards. Here's one that I thought you might like. It's called Lucinda Matlock. This is her story. "I went to the dances at Chandlerville and played snap out at Winchester. One time we changed partners driving home in the moonlight in middle June, and then I found Davis. We were married and lived together for 70 years, enjoying, working, raising the 12 children, 8 of whom we lost ere I had reached the age of 60. I spun, I wove, I kept the house, I nursed the sick, I made the garden, and for holiday rambled over the fields where sang the larks, and by Spoon River gathering many a shell and many a flower and medicinal herb, shouting to the wooded hills, singing to the green valleys. At 96 I had lived enough, that is all, and passed to a sweet repose. What is this I hear of sorrow and weariness, anger, discontent, and drooping hopes? Degenerate sons and daughters, life is too strong for you. It takes life to love life." Then there's the story of Fiddler Jones. He gets his 2 cents in. He says, "The earth keeps some vibration going there in your heart, and that is you. And if the people find you can fiddle, why, fiddle you must for all your life. What do you see, a harvest of clover or a meadow to walk through to the river? The winds and the corn. You rub your hands for beeves hereafter ready for market, or else you hear the rustle of skirts like the girls when dancing at Little Grove to Cooney Potter, a pillar of dust or whirling leaves meant ruinous drought. They look to me like redhead Sammy stepping off to tour allure. How could I till my 40 acres, not to speak of getting more, with a medley of horns, bassoons, and piccolos stirred in my brain by crows and robins and the creak of the windmill? Only these? And I never started to plow in my life that someone did not stop in the road and take me away to a dance or a picnic. I ended up with 40 acres. I ended up with a broken fiddle and a broken laugh and 1,000 memories and not a single regret. There's an Irish poet that I like very much, William Butler Yeats. Being Irish myself, I like him even more. I'm one of the few Missouri-centered Irishmen, I'm sure. I don't know how I got in the Missouri. I'm sure it's not an interesting story at all, if it's a story. But I can remember when I first started teaching in Lutheran schools. I used to go a couple of times to worship and arts, music and arts, worship society or whatever. And they'd always, somebody would tell some German joke in German. And they'd laugh, and the guy next to me would nudge me in the ribs, and I'd just blank expression, so he started nudging the other guy, but I couldn't respond. And then he'd tell a joke in German and say how they couldn't say it in English, so I just finally figured I just wasn't going to get anything out of that at all, not speaking German. I think they really thought I wasn't Lutheran because I couldn't speak German. I didn't tell them I was Irish. But Yeats is... Here's a poem, which is another good poem for this kind of weather. Yeah, I walked up and down the road today 2 or 3 times, rain or no rain. I saw all these clouds up in the passes. Almost looked like a volcano, didn't it? Some of those peaks up there.
Yeah.
It looks like something you'd like to be in, but you're kind of glad you're not, right? You think, gee, that looks mysterious. And it is. I just think something is up there now that's not up there when it's hot and sunny. Like when I was a kid on the farm in Southern Illinois where I was born, something is out there in those woods when it was dark. In the daytime, I was in the woods, right? But in the night, sitting under the trees, maple trees, with my granny telling me ghost stories, I'd look out in those woods and I'd, oh, no way I'm going to go out there to put down. And my cousin and I always catching fireflies and sticking them in bottles or shoving them up each other's nose or something. He'd say, Jack, you want to go down to the creek? I said, no way. There's something down there. And my granny, of course, fed this by always saying there was. You bet. There's all kinds of things down there. I don't know where those things came from. They're always at night, though. In the daytime, they were never around. I never bothered about them. My grandmother, bless her heart, never let me forget that they were there. And if I wasn't good, she would willingly or no take me by the hand down to the creek and leave me on the little gorge across the creek in the middle of the trees. Then she says, if you come back, I guarantee you'll be a good boy. Oh! I said, Granny, I'm good right now. I'll be good. Really? He said, good, I'll squeak. And then Bill and I were good for at least 1 or 2 hours. Anyway, this is one of those kinds of poems. It's called The Song of Wandering Angus. It's mysterious, but it's not evil. Kind of like my granny tried to scare me. It's just mysterious. I went out to the hazel wood because a fire was in my head and cut and peeled a hazel wand and hooked a berry to a thread. And when white moths were on the wing and moth-like stars were flickering out, I dropped the berry in a stream and caught a little silver trout. When I had laid it on the floor, I went to blow the fire aflame, but something rustled on the floor. Someone called me by my name. It had become a glimmering girl with apple blossom in her hair, who called me by my name and ran and faded through the brightening air. Though I am old with wandering through hollow lands and hilly lands, I will find out where she has gone and kiss her lips and take her hands and walk among long dappled grass and pluck till time and times are done the silver apples of the moon, the golden apples of the sun. William Butler Yeats is a great, great Irish poet, just a great poet, Irish or no. in my opinion, the greatest poet since Wordsworth, which just kind of obliterates Browning and Tennyson and all kinds of great people. But I think he's really an excellent poet. This poem, The Lake Isle of Innisfree, is the kind of poem that, yeah, I think it speaks to that Shangri-La or that 150 acres of Connecticut hillside or wherever your dream is. It was Innisfree for Yeats, and he always wanted to go back. I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honeybee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the veils of the morning to where the cricket sings. There midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. While I stand on the roadway or on the pavement's gray, I hear it in the deep heart's core. By the way, if you feel like saying anything or asking questions, I hope you do. Otherwise, I'll just, like a little worm, get my nose in my book and just burrow into these poems. So just feel free to say anything or request a poem. If I've got it, I'll be glad to read it. Are there any requests? Like Saturday night at the piano. Well, let me read one more while you're thinking of a request. I don't care if you think too hard, really. There's one last one by Yeats. I wasn't going to read this one. It's called When You Are Old. I really like this poem. Years ago, maybe you saw this commercial, it was on television, for Braille Institute, and it showed an elderly lady sitting by the fire reading poems by Braille, and this Alexander Scorby, who has a beautiful reading voice and does Excedrin commercials, you've probably heard his voice a million times, read this poem for the commercial. It's a beautiful poem called When You're Old. When you are old and gray and full of sleep and nodding by the fire, take down this book and slowly read and dream of the soft look your eyes had once and of their shadows deep. How many loved your moments of glad grace and loved your beauty with love false or true. But one man loved the pilgrim soul in you and loved the sorrows of your changing face. And bending down beside the glowing bars, murmur a little sadly how love fled and paced upon the mountains overhead and hid his face amid a crowd of stars. Think of a request. Go back to Frost and mending fences. Mending wall. All right. Something there is that doesn't love a wall. That's as far as my memory gets me. Okay. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen ground swell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps, I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring, mending time, we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go, to each the boulders that have fallen to each. And some are loaves, and some so nearly balls we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side, it comes to little more. There where it is we do not need the wall, he is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. The owner says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? Here there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I would like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only, in the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well, he says again, good fences make good neighbors.
Death of a hired man.
Okay. Yes, good the epic folks here. Yeah. And he likes having thought of it so well, he says again, good fences make good neighbors.
Death of a hired man.
Okay. Yes, good news. The epic folks here. Yeah. Should have brought some coffee with me. Robert Frost, in addition to saying all kinds of other really interesting things besides just his poems, once said that writing poetry without rhyme is like playing tennis without a net. And then he proceeded to write Death of a Hired Man, which you've asked for, which has no rhyme. Everything he wrote was good. His rhyme is excellent, very natural. And when he decided he didn't want to rhyme, that too was excellent and natural. This is a poem about a farmer and his wife, Mary, and they're sitting, the husband has just come home from the fields, and Mary is sitting on the porch waiting for him, and it's twilight, and he's about to go in and get some coffee or something, and she says, wait a minute, Silas has come home. Silas is the hired man, and Silas hasn't been very dependable. He's come and gone, you know. And so that's the context of the poem. Mary sat musing on the lamp flame at the table, waiting for Warren. When she heard his step, she ran on tiptoe down the darkened passage to meet him in the doorway with the news and put him on his guard. Silas is back. She pushed him outward with her through the door and shut it after her. Be kind, she said. She took the market things from Warren's arms and set them on the porch, then drew him down to sit beside her on the wooden steps. When was I ever anything but kind to him? But I'll not have the fellow back, he said. I told him so last haying, didn't I? If he left then, I said, that ended it. What good is he? Who else will harbor him at his age for the little he can do? What help he is, there's no depending on. Off he goes always when I need him most. He thinks he ought to earn a little pay, enough at least to buy tobacco with, so he won't have to beg and be beholden. All right, I say, I can't afford to pay any fixed wages, though I wish I could. Someone else can, and someone else will have to. I shouldn't mind his bettering himself, if that's what it was. You can be certain when he begins like that, there's someone at him trying to coax him off with pocket money in haying time, when any help is scarce. In winter, he comes back to us. I'm done. Shh, not so loud. He'll hear you, Mary said. I want him to. He'll have to sooner or later. He's worn out. He's asleep beside the stove. When I came up from Rose, I found him here huddled against the barn door fast asleep. A miserable sight and frightening, too. You needn't smile. I didn't recognize him. I wasn't looking for him. And he's changed. Wait till you see. Where did you say he'd been? He didn't say. I dragged him to the house and gave him tea and tried to make him smoke. I tried to make him talk about his travels. Nothing would do. He just kept nodding on. What did he say? Did he say anything? But little. Anything. Mary, confess. He said he'd come to ditch the meadow for me. Warren. But did he? I just want to know. Of course he did. What would you have him say? Surely you wouldn't grudge the poor old man some humble way to save his self-respect, he added. If you really care to know, he meant to clear the upper pasture, too. That sounds like something you've heard before. Warren, I wish you could have heard the way he jumbled everything. I stopped to look two or three times. He made me feel so queer to see if he was talking in his sleep. He ran on Harold Wilson, you remember? The boy you had in Hague 4 years since. He's finished school and teaching in his college. Silas declares you'll have to get him back. He says they two will make a team for work. Between them, they will lay this farm as smooth, the way he mixed that in with other things. He thinks young Wilson a likely lad, though daft on education. You know how they fought all through July under the blazing sun, Silas up on the cart to build the load, and Harold along beside to pitch it on. Yes, I took care to keep well out of earshot. Well, those days trouble Silas like a dream. You wouldn't think they would. How some things linger. Harold's young college boy's assurance piqued him. After so many years, he still keeps finding good arguments he sees he might have used. I sympathize. I know just how it feels to think of the right thing to say too late. Harold's associated in his mind with Latin. He asked me what I thought of Harold saying he studied Latin like the violin because he liked it. That an argument. He said he couldn't make the boy believe he could find water with a hazel prong, which showed how much good school had ever done him. He wanted to go over that. But most of all, he thinks if he could have another chance to teach him how to build a load of hay. I know, that's Silas's one accomplishment. He bundles every forkful in its place and tags and numbers it for future reference so he can find it and easily dislodge it in the unloading. Silas does that well. He takes it out in bunches like big birds' nests. You never see him standing on the hay he's trying to lift, straining to lift himself. He thinks if he could teach him that, he'd be some good, perhaps, to someone in the world. He hates to see a boy the fool of books. Poor Silas, so concerned for other folk, and nothing to look backward to with pride, and nothing to look forward to with hope. So now, and never any different. Part of the moon was falling down the west, dragging the whole sky with it to the hills. Its light poured softly in her lap. She saw and spread her apron to it. She put out her hand among the harp-like morning glory strings, taut with dew from garden bed to eaves, as if she played unheard the tenderness that wrought on him beside her in the night. Warren, she said, he has come home to die. You needn't be afraid he'll leave you this time. Home, he mocked gently. Yes, what else but home? It all depends on what you mean by home. Of course, he's nothing to us any more than was the hound that came a stranger to us out of the woods worn out upon the trail. Home is the place where when you have to go there, they have to take you in. I should have called it something you somehow haven't to deserve. Warren leaned out and took a step or two, picked up a little stick and brought it back, and broke it in his hand and tossed it by. Silas has better claim on us, you think, than on his brother. 13 little miles as the road winds would bring him to his door. Silas has walked that far, no doubt, today. Why didn't he go there? His brother's rich, a somebody, director in the bank. He never told us that. We know it, though. I think his brother ought to help, of course. I'll see to that if there is need. He ought to write to take him in and might be willing to. He may be better than appearances, but have some pity on Silas. Do you think if he had any pride in claiming kin or anything he looked for from his brother, he'd keep so still about him all this time? I wonder what's between them. I can tell you. Silas is what he is. We wouldn't mind him, but just the kind that kinsfolk can't abide. He never did a thing so very bad. He don't know why he isn't quite as good as anybody. Worthless though he is, he won't be made ashamed to please his brother. I can't think Si ever hurt anyone. No, but he hurt my heart the way he lay and rolled his old head on that sharp-edged chair back. He wouldn't let me put him on the lounge. You must go in and see what you can do. I made up the bed for him there tonight. You'll be surprised at him, how much he's broken. His working days are done, I'm sure of it. I'd not be in a hurry to say that. I haven't been. Go. Look for yourself. But Warren, please remember how it is. He has come to help you ditch the meadow. He has a plan. You mustn't laugh at him. He may not speak of it, and then he may. I'll sit and see if that small sailing cloud will hit or miss the moon. It hit the moon. Then there were three there, making a dim row. The moon, the little silver cloud, and she. Warren returned too soon, it seemed to her, slipped to her side, caught up her hand, and waited. Warren, she questioned. Dead, was all he answered. Kind of hard to follow that one, folks. That's a marvelous poem, isn't it?
When you go there, they have to take you in.
Yep. Home is the place where when you have to go there, they have to take you in. And then she follows that by saying, I should have thought that home is something you somehow haven't to deserve, which is almost as good. You don't have to deserve home. Home is something you somehow haven't to deserve. Thank you. Thank you. Bless your heart. All of you here. Thank you.
Would you do one of your own?
I'd love to do one of my own, and they're all up in the chalet. And I'm gonna do my own tomorrow at 6:45. I didn't bring any of my own. I just wanted to read some other.
Jeff, can you come with a thank you?
Want to read that one?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I. Tomorrow I will. I can't tonight. I just don't have them. When I read Frost, I'm convinced that Frost is the greatest poet America has produced. Then I get to read Walt Whitman, and I think there's nobody like Walt Whitman. Today I talked about Emily Dickinson, and I thought, nobody is better than Emily Dickinson. And of course, nobody is. Are there any other requests? Ruth just asked me to read one, and while I find it, maybe you can... why don't you find it for me? Ruth. Anybody have a poem they'd like to hear? I don't have all the books in the world, huh?
Do you have any of Edmonton?
Yeah, sure do. Anything in particular you'd like?
Oh, I can't remember the title. The Branston Dripping Apple Tree.
Boy, that sounds good. I don't know that. I'd like to.
The world stands out on either side. I'm sorry, I don't know.
Oh, I'm sorry. I hear I ask for a request and I don't understand what. Let me find one by Millay. What have you got there by Millay, Ruth?
Yeah.
How about love is not all? It is not meat or drink. That's a good one. Love is not all. It is not meat nor drink, nor slumber, nor a roof against the rain, nor yet a floating spar to men that sink and rise and sink and rise and sink again. Love cannot fill the thickened lung with breath, nor clean the blood, nor set the fractured bone. Yet many a man is making friends with death, even as I speak, for lack of love alone. It well may be that in a difficult hour, pinned down by pain and moaning for release, or nagged by want past resolution's power, I might be driven to sell your love for peace, or trade the memory of this night for food. It well may be. I do not think I would. I heard that read one night by someone who really read it well and gave me an altogether different picture. I've always thought of this as a very noble kind of a sentiment. That, you know, love conquers all. And the person read those last lines, I might be driven to sell your love for peace, or trade the memory of this night for food. It well may be. I do not think I would. All of a sudden, I thought, no, no. She wouldn't do it that way. Yeah. Cummings? All depends how you read it. Right. You can find it in there. Any porcupines around here, Rudy? Okay, I'm going to read you a poem called The Porcupine by a fine Welsh poet named Galway Connell. What a name. The guy named Galway Connell has got to be an artist of some kind, right? Galway. Yeah. It's Porcupine. Maybe I'm not going to read Porcupine. Calling, 2, 4?
Four.
To begin. Okay. The number of you have to go, fine. Cool. Fatted on herbs, swollen on crab apples, puffed up on bast and phlegm, ballooned on willow flowers, poplar catkins, first leaves of aspen in March, the porcupine drags and bounces his last meal through ice, mud, roses, and goldenrod into the stubbly high fields. In character, he resembles us in seven ways. He puts his mark on outhouses. He alchemizes by moonlight. He shits on the run. He uses his tail for climbing. He chuckles softly to himself when scared. He's overcrowded. If there's more than one of him for 5 acres, his eyes have their own inner redness. Digger of goings across floors, of hesitations, of thresholds, of handprints, of dread, at doorpost, on window jamb, he would gouge the world empty of us, hack and crater it, until it is nothing, if that could rinse it all of our sweat and pathos. A door of axe handles, a flow of grain, of arms of Morris chairs, of handcrafted objects steeped in the juice of fingertips, of surfaces wetted down with fist grease and elbow oil, of clothespins that have grabbed our body rags by underarm and crotch. Unimpressed, bored by the whirl of the stars, by these he's astonished, ultra-Rilkean angel, for whom the true portion of the sweetness of earth is one of those bottom-heavy, glittering, saccadic bits of salt water that splash down the haunted ravines of the human face. A farmer shot a porcupine 3 times as it dozed on a tree limb. On the way down, it tore open its belly on a broken branch, hooked its gut, and went on falling. On the ground, it sprang to its feet and, paying out gut, heaved and spartled through 100 feet of goldenrod before the abrupt emptiness. The Avesta puts porcupine killers into hell for 9 generations, sentencing them to gnaw out each other's hearts for the salts of desire. I roll this way and that in the great bed under the quilt that mimics this country of broken farms and woods, the fatty sheath of the man melting off, the self-stabbing coil of bristles reversing, blossoming outward, a red-eyed, hard-toothed, arrow-stuck urchin tossing up mattress feathers, pricking the woman beside me until she cries. In my time I have crouched, quills erected, Saint Sebastian of the Sacred Heart, and been beat dead with a locust club on the bare snout, and have fallen from high places. I have fled, have jogged over fields of goldenrod, terrified, seeking home, and among flowers I have come to myself, the rope strung out behind me in the fall sun, suddenly glorified with all my blood. And tonight I think I prowl broken-skulled or vacant as a sucked egg in the wintry meadow, softly chuckling, blank template of myself, dragging a starved belly through the lichen-flowered acres where burdock looses the arcs of its seed and thistles holds up its lost blooms, and rose bushes in the wind scrape their dead limbs for the forced fire of roses. It's a powerful poem. Starts out about porcupines, and all of a sudden you're not quite sure what it's about. Well, let me close with one poem, and we'll call it a night. It's been nice to have you here, by the way. I want to read you a poem. You never found that one, huh? Oh, you did?
Okay.
I want to read a poem called Piano, since this is Piano. Rich Cameron said this was Piano. Not Thursday, but Piano. I'm going to read you a poem called Piano. It's by D.H. Lawrence. And you all know D.H. Lawrence, right? He wrote all the dirty books that were banned for years and years and made them all bestsellers. Like Lady Chatterley's Lover and Women in Love and Sons and Lovers. And he was also a very, very fine poet in addition to being an excellent novelist and short story writer. Got great poems about animals. Sometime when you have nothing to do, pick up his poems about animals. They are fantastic. But this one's called Piano. And we'll close with this one. A woman is singing to me, taking me back down the vista of years till I see a child sitting under the piano in the boom of the tingling strings and pressing the small, poised feet of a mother who smiles as she sings. In spite of myself, the insidious mastery of song betrays me back till the heart of me weeps to belong to the old Sunday evenings at home with winter outside and hymns in the cozy parlor, the tinkling piano our guide. So now it is vain for the singer to burst into clamor with the great black piano appassionata. The glamour of childish days is upon me. My manhood is cast down in a flood of remembrance. I weep like a child for the past. Thank you for coming tonight.